So I'm going to talk to you today about experiences, things like pain, anxiety, emotional distress, and these things are fundamentally important to our lives. And if the legal system is going to connect with the things that are important in our lives, then they have to be relevant to the legal system. Nevertheless, I'm going to argue that we often ignore or downplay subjective experiences in the law, and we do it not because our theories of law or our theories of ethics tell us that we should, but rather, we do it because it's just too expensive to try to figure out what other people are experiencing, or it's just too difficult to do it. So, as difficult as it has been, this is gradually beginning to change. New technologies are just starting to give us greater insight into people's experiences of things like pain and emotional distress. So in what I call the experiential future, our ability to assess the experiences of other people are going to get easier and it's going to get cheaper to do. My central claim is that as these new technologies emerge to better reveal people's subjective experiences, the law ought to do more things to take these experiences into account. Most of the technologies I'm going to discuss today are still at early stages, but I'm going to say at the end why the experiential future matters to us even today. You may remember the classical utilitarians, and they thought that the only thing that had intrinsic value were experiences like pleasure and happiness, and the only thing that had intrinsic disvalue were things like sadness and pain. There was a famous challenge to this by Robert Nozick, and he had this hypothetical known as the experience machine. He asks us to imagine that you could hook up your brain to a machine that could give you any experience you might want. You want to be a beloved billionaire, a famous celebrity, a successful poet. You hook up to the machine, and you can have any sort of experience that you'd want. And the question that I'm going to ask you is, would you connect to such a machine? So I'm going to poll the room in a moment, but I'll just give you a little bit more information about the experience machine. Okay, so you have these experts, and they've picked out really good lives, really enjoyable lives, I should say, right? They're experientially very good, so you don't have to worry about that. If you prefer, you can plan your own little life module, and you can hook up for the rest of your life, or you can do it for a couple of years, and then maybe change the module. And you don't have to worry about other people. You don't have to worry about your family and other people in the world. Nozick says, assume they're hooked up to the machine, too. Okay, so that's the general information, and the question I'm going to ask you is, would you connect? So raise your hand if you'd connect. Okay, so my eyeball is maybe, you know, 1/20th of the room, right? Maybe 5% of you, a really small number, and that's consistent with what Robert Nozick thought. Nozick thought that most of us would not connect to such a machine, and what does that tell us? It tells us that we must care about other things aside from just subjective experiences. Now, I'm not sure that Nozick's example is quite as successful in making his point as is generally thought. One way to test that is to think about the experience machine in reverse. You might imagine that you're connected to an experience machine right now. You're probably a very different person in the real world than you seem to think that you are right now. You probably have different friends and different family. And what else is your life like off of this experience machine that you're on now? Well, you're probably having less pleasure and happiness, because otherwise you wouldn't have gotten onto this experience machine in the first place. In fact, it's quite possible that you are all connected to experience machines right now. You're not really in this room. I'm not really talking to you. You're simply having that experience. We wouldn't know the difference. And so now the question is, I'm going to ask you, would you disconnect from the experience machine that you're currently on now? Okay, so raise your hand if you would disconnect. Okay, more than last time, but not so different, right? Maybe 5% the first time, and only 10% would disconnect. That seems to mean that most of you just want the status quo. If you're not on an experience machine, you don't want to get on one, and if you're on one, you want to stay on it. So that suggests to me that Robert Nozick's example isn't quite as strong as it's generally taken to be. But there's another important point, and that is, let's assume that Nozick is right. Let's assume that there really are other things that matter aside from just subjective experiences. Well, that doesn't mean that subjective experiences aren't important. They're just among the many important things in our lives. Obviously, avoiding things like chronic pain are really important, and so the law needs to be in touch with that consideration. Okay, so let's turn to the technologies, and we turn first to physical pain. Damages from pain and suffering may constitute as much as half of all damage awards in personal injury cases. So lots of millions and billions of dollars are changing hands in things like tort litigation. That's when one person suing another person, say, for negligently harming them in a car accident. And there are other ways in which pain and suffering are addressed: disability hearings, workers' compensation. And so you got all this money changing hands, and we have a problem. That is, it's really hard to know what other people are experiencing. So even if people who are faking their pain represent just a really small percentage of people, when you look at the whole system, it's a lot of money. There's a flip side problem too. And those are people who have genuine pain, but they just have trouble demonstrating it to other people. They have trouble finding objective evidence. And so a technology that might fix this problem or help it in any way would be really wonderful and potentially very helpful. We recognize our own pain through introspection. We're the best experts on what we're feeling. I call this the walking in Memphis principle, right? In that song, Mark Cohn says, he's walking in Memphis, "Do I really feel the way I feel?" Well, the answer is yes. He really does feel the way he feels. It's not clear that it could be any different than that. When it comes to other people, though, it's much harder. We have to make inferences. So you may know doctors will sometimes ask people to rate their pain on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the worst pain imaginable. But of course, my number 7 pain may not be the same as your number 7 pain. I may have a very vivid imagination about the very terrible things you could do to another person to cause them pain. So I rate my pain very low. So to some extent, this test, these self-reports, may just as well be measuring our imaginations as they're measuring pain levels. Okay, despite the difficulties, the tort system, meaning again, when one person's suing another person, malpractice, car accident, that sort of thing, it says that you're supposed to measure the amounts of pain that people suffer. You're not supposed to say it's $5,000 for the pain of a broken arm and $10,000 for the pain of a broken leg. This bit of law or collection of case law called the Restatement of Torts tells us that you're supposed to estimate fair and reasonable compensation for pain and suffering for individual litigants by noting such factors as the intensity of the pain, its actual or probable duration, and the expectable consequences. That's really hard to do. Nevertheless, that's what the law tells us. So to the extent that technologies make this better, we ought to use them. Okay, so brain imaging. Now, there's structural brain imaging, where we're basically looking at tissue in the brain, not what it's doing, but sort of where it is, its placement relative to other parts of the brain. And there's functional imaging, where we're looking at what's the brain doing, what's the activity going on in the brain. And we'll start with structural brain imaging. So in 2004, researchers used traditional structural magnetic resonance imaging, the same thing you might have done for a knee or for your head or something like that at some point in the past. And they found when they look at a group of people that have chronic back pain versus a group of people that do not have chronic back pain, they found some structural differences. They found a lower volume of gray matter in the neocortex of the back pain group than the ordinary healthy group. There was a positive correlation between loss in brain volume and the duration of the chronic pain. Other studies have used a technology called diffusion tensor imaging. It looks at the way things are connected in the brain, and they claim to find certain structural differences, again, in a group of people with chronic back pain and a group of people without it. But we can also look at brain activity using functional MRI, and what we find is that under fMRI, certain regions of the brain show greater activation in subjects when they're exposed to acute painful stimuli. The amount of activation increases with the intensity of the pain. So this suggests that we might be able to someday, and again, the talk is called the experiential future of the law because it's looking out, we might be able to say something about what someone's experiencing in terms of the level, although that's very difficult to do. There are also some studies that suggest that that people who have chronic pain respond to acute pain differently than people who don't have chronic pain. And that suggests that we might be able to put people who have chronic pain into a brain scanner, give them an acute stimulus like some heat, and try to see how their brains respond and try to see if they demonstrate a pattern that's more consistent with being a person who has chronic back pain or a person who doesn't. There's at least one company that's already trying to market services like this. And I know of at least one workers' compensation case where the injured party at least explored using this kind of evidence. Now, I think that If you polled a bunch of neuroscientists, most of them would say that the technology isn't there yet. But remember, from the perspective of the law, we need to worry about these technologies before the scientists have agreed that they work. We have to worry about it because someone can try to introduce it in court, and we have to try to decide whether it meets the standard of evidence that we think is appropriate for admission into the court. And oftentimes, those tests happen before we have scientists who can confidently say, okay, this is a regular part of, let's say, medical practice. See, if doctors were using it, people would feel pretty confident in it, and doctors would have a lot of use for a technology like this. Someone comes in and says, I have all these pains, and you might want some measure of exactly what it is in a way that they might not be able to convey to you using their own ability to express their pain. Or you might imagine that someone's coming in because they just want narcotics, and potentially brain imaging will someday tell us something about that. But before we get too excited, there are whole lots of caveats. So one important one has to do with a difference that Adrian Raine mentioned between looking at one group versus another group and saying something important about individual people. Lots of the research that we have now is just looking at groups of people, and that's not ideal. For the courtroom, we'd like a technology that tells us something about the experiences of an individual person. That being said, there are some studies that do look at individual people. So there was a recent study that basically trained up a system known as a pattern classification system by putting people in a scanner and exposing them to different levels of pain. And it then analyzed that data, and based on that, we could now expose the person to new stimuli, new heat stimuli, and make pretty good predictions about how that person would rate their own pain just by looking at their brain activity. And that's a very promising study that looks at individual brains. But how often we can do this and how well we can do this remains to be seen. There's lots of variation in the way that people experience pain. Brains are very different. And so as we learn more about that, it's going to affect the prospects for the technology. And of course, that raises the issue of countermeasures. In the study I just described to you, they had people exposed to pain, and then they rated their own pain, and that's how we trained the computer. Well, if we were doing this in a courtroom system, you could imagine someone who's trying to cheat that, right? They're going to say that everything's extremely painful so that when we use it in some forensic context, we'll get results that are inaccurate. So we always have to be on the lookout for countermeasures, right? It's sort of like the technology goes in one direction, the countermeasures, and then we have to have countermeasures to the countermeasures. It's not necessarily impossible. In the death penalty context, the Supreme Court has said you can't execute someone if their IQ demonstrates that they have severe mental retardation. Well, you might say, well, isn't everyone going to demonstrate that they have severe mental retardation so they don't get the death penalty? And the answer is, well, we have tests that try to figure out when a person is cheating the system. And so we probably will need the same sorts of things with brain imaging technologies in the courtroom. The key point, though, is not that these technologies are going to be perfect. They're not going to be. But that's not what we need. What we need is something where we introduce it into the court system and we end up getting better results on the other end. Okay, so the test is, can we use this to improve the kinds of outcomes that we're getting in a cost-effective way? That's physical pain. What about emotional pain? Well, we've had for a long time psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers try to assess things like anxiety and distress and depression, and it's difficult. It's very difficult to do, and it's possible that in the future brain imaging will help this in some regard. And I think this is even more futuristic than physical pain. But there are some studies that find that things like chronic stress can lead to certain structural changes in the brain. There are some suggestions that people with certain kinds of psychiatric disorders demonstrate different kind of brain activity under various conditions. So it's possible that in the future we will have better measures of experiences. And now I can connect this point to the law. The law has all sorts of doctrines that are designed to ignore subjective experience in various ways. Consider a tort known as the negligent infliction of emotional distress. Somebody was negligent, and it caused you lots of anxiety, stress, bad dreams, that sort of thing. The law makes it very difficult to bring a claim like that. Why is that? Well, I think there's two reasons. One is that we don't want just any sort of emotional wrong to deserve compensation through the court system. So someone makes you the butt of a mild joke, we might say, no, that's not strong enough to qualify for a negligent infliction of distress claim. But there's another reason why we're very skeptical, and we add all these proxies in to make sure that there's sufficient emotional distress. And the reason for that is, we don't believe you. We don't believe you when you say you were extremely upset by this event. So what are some of the things that the law does? The law creates proxies. So for example, some jurisdictions will require that if you're the victim of emotional distress, that you also had some kind of physical impact. So you were emotionally distressed by something someone did, were you also experiencing physical impact from, say, a car crash or being punched or something like that? Other jurisdictions will require physical manifestations of the emotional distress. It's not enough that you say, oh, I was extremely upset by what happened. You have to demonstrate that you were vomiting or that you're waking up in the middle of the night with nightmares or that sort of thing. So we have these proxies. And the claim would be that in the future, when we have better measures of experiential distress, that the law will have to reconsider some of these proxies because they may not be as appropriate. Other kinds of experiences that we're getting better at understanding have to do with disorders of consciousness. So you may have heard of a study from a few years ago about a woman who was believed to be in a persistent vegetative state. And they asked her things, they gave her suggestions of things to do, like imagining, for example, that she's playing tennis or imagining that she's navigating her home. And what they saw when they did this in this particular unusual patient was that her brain activity when she was imagining playing tennis was not so unlike the activity you or I would demonstrate under the same circumstances, and same thing for navigating around in one's home. That's pretty remarkable because it's typically thought that a person in a persistent vegetative state is not having thoughts like that. A little bit more recently, this same kind of technology was used to communicate with someone who had also been believed to be in a vegetative state. And so what they did was, well, if we can distinguish these signals, the signal of thinking you're playing tennis versus imagining that you're navigating in your home, then we might be able to answer certain questions this way. So the patient was asked questions like, do you have any brothers? If yes, imagine that you're playing tennis. If no, imagine that you're navigating around in your home. And the subject was able to correctly answer several of these questions and didn't get any wrong. That's pretty remarkable. So as a legal and ethical question, it makes us ask, in the future, might we want to try to communicate with people who are minimally conscious to say, do you want to be removed from this ventilator? A question that we might not have ever thought possible before. And what would we want to know about the person's mental states before we would feel confident that the person's competent to make decisions like that? You may have heard about people working on lie detection using brain imaging. This is an area that I think is even much harder to do than figuring out something like physical pain, right? Lies are hard to know what they are. It's hard to catch it exactly when someone's having a deceptive thought. So I see that as a technology that's even further into the future. But if such a technology ever became reliable, you could also imagine asking people about their experiences. Is it true that you wake up in the morning with crippling back pain? And then we could see whether or not they're being deceptive. But again, I think that that's a technology that's much more difficult to do. But I think it illustrates an interesting point about why we want to think about the future today. And it has to do with something I call the technological look-back principle. So let's say you ask most neuroscientists today, and they'll tell you, no, this brain imaging for lie detection technology doesn't work. But a lot would say that it might work in 20 or 30 years from now. And what does that mean? That means that all sorts of behaviors that you're engaging in now that you think are secretive might not be in the future. Because 30 years from now, we can ask you about what you did in 2011. Did you go to a strip club? Did you cheat on your wife? Where did you bury the body? Questions that you might think, you know, you've planned the perfect crime or that your wife will never discover that such and such happened. Well, in fact, it's not clear that you'll be able to keep it secretly so easily. And you might think that there will be certain kinds of protections, right? This is our brain. Don't we have certain First Amendment interests in keeping information like this private? And maybe certain other kinds of information, like the amount of distress you're feeling. And the answer is that maybe yes. I mean, it's hard to predict that, but maybe we do have some of these interests. But again, those kinds of protections don't work in every context. So I have a colleague who called up one of these brain imaging lie detection services and said, I want to know if my husband's cheating on me. And the person at the company said, great, bring him in, and we'll put him in the scanner, and we'll see. There is no legal protection for that, right? That's just you and your spouse and deciding what you're going to do. Or take, for example, politicians who reveal their tax returns. They're not required by law to show you their tax returns, but they do it because their competitor is doing it, and they want to show that they're quite as open as their competitors. So in the future, even if we have these constitutional protections about our brains and what kinds of things you can do to us, it doesn't mean that politicians won't say, and I will agree to be placed in one of these machines, and you're going to ask me whether I've ever taken a bribe or whether I have all sorts of conflicts of interest. So that's a technological look-back principle, and that's a discussion about some issues in the civil law, in the tort context, about experiences. Let's look to the future and think about the criminal law. So blameworthiness, how might information related to the brain tell us something about whether a crime has been committed? We already use brain imaging to tell us something about, say, child physical abuse, right? Is there trauma to the brain? Is there trauma to different parts of the body? That's been used for a long time. Sexual abuse is much more difficult because often there's no physical evidence to demonstrate that the crime occurred. There might be a pregnancy or an STD or something like that, but oftentimes there's no such evidence. And as you know, sometimes we're looking at these crimes from a long time ago, maybe 30 years in the past, and it's really difficult to find that sort of evidence. Now, we can ask people what happened, was there such a crime, but we don't always trust that information. We don't always trust people's recollections from the distant past. And so we might wonder, are there any sorts of biomarkers that might demonstrate some sort of child sexual abuse from a long time ago? And not yet, but maybe someday in the future. So let me mention to you one study that's at least suggestive about what sorts of things might happen to the future. It's a study from Nature Neuroscience from within the last couple years. And they identified a potential biomarker of childhood abuse in brain tissue. And they looked at three groups of people. They looked at people who committed suicide, who had been victims of childhood abuse when they were children. They looked at people who committed suicide who had not been victimized as children, and then they looked at a control group. And they looked at for a particular biomarker, an epigenetic marker in brain tissue, and they found statistical differences among the groups. So they found that the group that had committed suicide and had been victimized by childhood abuse had lower levels of this glucocorticoid receptor being expressed in their brain tissue than they saw in the other groups. So that suggests that the fact of having been abused as a child might have done something to their brains, at least at the group level. Lots of limitations in this study. It was a small sample size. It's yet to be repeated. It has that problem of being group data rather than individual data. Epigenetics is something new. We don't know exactly what might be causing these changes. Suicide is a very extreme kind of situation. It's unlikely to distinguish different forms of childhood adversity. So sexual abuse might look like neglect, which might look like having witnessed a car accident or all sorts of other kinds of adversity. And another big problem is that you had to use brain tissue. That's why it was done on people who had already died. But let's suppose that the science does prove useful. Let's suppose that we can refine this technique. You can imagine using it in a case like similar to the one that happened with Michael Jackson. So Michael Jackson died, he had children, and Michael Jackson had claimed that when he was a child, he had been abused by his own father. Suppose that Michael Jackson's father had sought custody of the grandchildren after Michael Jackson died. You could imagine trying to examine Michael Jackson's brain tissue to see if there were epigenetic markers that he had been abused as a child. Notice that this kind of evidence, even if it were to work, would be very asymmetric. Suppose that we saw evidence that he had been abused. That wouldn't mean that it was his father who was the cause of it. It doesn't mean that he wasn't just the victim of some other kind of childhood adversity. But suppose the science is reliable and we don't see any markers of the abuse, that would be some evidence that his father did not abuse him if the technology pans out. And they're working on finding these epigenetic markers in other kinds of tissue aside from brain tissue, like white blood cells. And if that were to work, we can imagine using it in different contexts. You've heard people mention the use of evidence at a capital trial during the sentencing hearing in mitigation. So this person's been convicted of killing someone or multiple people, and they want to say, even though that's the case, don't give me the death penalty. And we've heard the idea of introducing evidence that a person had a rotten childhood background, all sorts of terrible things that happened. Well, this might be some kind of evidence that a person had rotten childhood background. And it's an area of the law where evidentiary requirements are a lot easier to satisfy than in a lot of other contexts. Okay, so what else could we use this for? We might use it to determine not just whether a crime occurred, but perhaps how blameworthy a person is. This is an area where the law right now doesn't do a very good job of distinguishing the amount of experiential pain a criminal perpetrator causes. So for example, we don't spend a lot of resources trying to figure out exactly how much pain did the victim of a crime experience. We're focusing on the statute that a criminal is charged with violating, but arguably information about the amount of pain a perpetrator causes could be relevant to their sentencing. We might think it matters whether this person is extremely cruel, were they aware of the amount of pain that they were causing? If so, that might suggest that they're going to be more dangerous in the future, perhaps more blameworthy. So we do distinguish, at some level, we'll distinguish crimes like simple assaults from aggravated assaults. Aggravated assaults might refer to causing extreme suffering to a victim, but it's rare. Generally speaking, we don't do that. We do it to some extent in sentencing, but the claim would be that in the experiential future where we know more about what victims suffer, we might want to take these factors into consideration to a greater degree. So far, I've been talking about culpability and blameworthiness. But there's another side to this, and that is, once we decide that a person's committed a crime, we punish them. But imagine two people who commit crimes that make them equally blameworthy. One we'll call sensitive, and one we'll call insensitive. And let's say they get the same sentence, 4 years in prison, identical conditions. Nevertheless, the sensitive prisoner experiences it differently. The sensitive prisoner is extremely anxious, stressed out, having bad dreams, while the insensitive prisoner doesn't like prison, but is basically functioning okay, gets used to it, copes with it reasonably well. And the question I want to plant in your minds is, though we normally think of these as equal sentences, are they in fact equal? Generally, we don't consider these sorts of things. In fact, lots of sentencing guidelines will encourage judges to not consider things like educational background and employment history and all sorts of features of an offender that might be relevant to knowing what they're experiencing. But maybe we should consider these things, or at least I want to plant that idea. There might be certain kinds of experiences that you think should count. If a person can demonstrate that they have extreme clinical claustrophobia, perhaps you'd be sympathetic to a case like that. Of course, you're going to be suspicious. You're going to doubt that they really have those symptoms, but in the experiential future, perhaps we'll have greater confidence in those kinds of assessments. Okay, a couple other areas aside from subjective experience. The death penalty. Some people on death row have argued that they should have special machines to monitor what they're experiencing as they're receiving lethal injections. There was one person in North Carolina a few years ago who successfully got the state to agree that he would be connected to this machine called a bispectral index monitor. And that's supposed to tell us something about the level of anesthesia that a person is undergoing. So you might see it in a surgery room. And this was a case where the person succeeded in getting the state to agree to allow the equipment to be used. In a Supreme Court case, a couple years ago, the Supreme Court said, you have no constitutional right to such equipment. But that doesn't mean that it's not a good idea to have it, right? You might think that if a person's going to undergo extreme agony and pain while being executed, but be unable to express it because they're paralyzed because of other drugs that are in them, that perhaps if we have a good technology that we're confident in, perhaps the next generation of bispectral index monitors, that it might be something that we'd want to include. Enhanced interrogation. That's a topic that gets a lot of discussion. Enhanced interrogation / torture. So a federal statute prohibits those acting under color of law, someone like a police officer, an interrogator, something like that, from engaging in acts, quote, intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering on people in their custody or control. What's interesting about the statute is that it refers specifically to severe physical or mental pain or suffering, and that's something for which technology might be able to tell us something important. There are all sorts of ways in which we might protect people from being the victims of torture. The one that seems to be the most common is to focus on categories of interrogation, things like waterboarding. The thing about waterboarding is that people are going to experience waterboarding quite differently. If you're a Navy SEAL who's been trained to withstand waterboarding kinds of interrogations, you're going to experience waterboarding very differently than someone who might have had a terrible traumatic experience as a child of drowning in a pool, right? That's two very different extremes. And so the suggestion might be that there might be additional ways that we might want to protect people from torture, one of which is to consider the sorts of things that people are experiencing while they're being interrogated under extreme or enhanced kinds of conditions. And this is not something that's so technologically difficult in the sense that measuring things like acute pain, we can look at respiration rates and blood pressure and pulse and the level of various stress hormones in people's urine. It's not so difficult to do something like this. I think the problem with it is that it sort of turns our stomach. We don't like the idea of measuring the distress of the terrible things that we do. And this to me is a little bit interesting and peculiar. I can understand not liking what we're doing to someone, right? Not imprisoning them under difficult circumstances or interrogating them under extremely intense circumstances. I can understand that. But it seems like the measurement should be or could be a kind of protective element. I think we're suspicious of that. We think that the measuring is being done for some more nefarious purpose. It's being done so that we can, you know, bring the pain up to the most legal level or something like that. But it's possible for it to serve a protective kind of role, especially if you think that the people measuring it are appropriately nonpartisan or not involved in, don't have the same vested interest that the interrogators might have. This doesn't mean that the psychologists and other people who were involved in enhanced interrogations after 9/11 should get off scot-free. It's very factually dependent on what's going on. Is it the kind of expert that's being called in to ratchet up pain in the most extreme way, or is it the sort of person that's actually serving a kind of protective role? Take, for example, the referee, the official at a boxing match, right? Here are people that are pounding each other, but we normally think not only that you should have a referee, but that, you know, it's mandatory, right? Because this serves a kind of protective role. So sometimes the person measuring the pain is something that we think is good, and other times it's not. Okay, so what does this mean for today? Why does the experiential future matter to us? I mean, I think one reason it matters is just because we're curious, we're interested in what our society might be like in the future, but there are some other reasons why we want to consider it today. One has to do with privacy, and you might not think that we have a great deal of interest in the privacy of things like our physical pain. Already we require litigants to demonstrate their physical pain in court by presenting medical evidence. So to some extent, some of these decisions have already been addressed by the courts in other kinds of contexts, but there are other sorts of experiences we might have that we might think should be have greater privacy protection. So there are people working on uncovering experiences of sexual arousal or pedophilic arousal, or various kinds of biases that might be reflected in the brain, gender biases or racial biases or various emotions associated with various kinds of stimuli. And perhaps we do have greater privacy interests in that sort of area where we want to start thinking about what exactly are our rights to our own memories and to our own thoughts. Second reason why you want to consider the experiential future today has to do with guiding the research. So again, I call it the experiential future because it's about what's going to happen in the future. But if we want to guide where we are in the future, we need to think about it today. And neuroscientists and lawyers and law professors may have different sorts of interests in research. So it could be that as a neuroscientist, you want to come out with the study that demonstrates which area of the brain is active under some condition or serves some role, and then you move on to the next area that will get you tenure or a Nobel Prize. By contrast, lawyers and law professors might have somewhat different interests. We want to refine a technology. We want to see what are the error rates associated with it. How many false positives will we have? And that sort of experiment is different than the one you might conduct if you're just trying to get your piece published in a reputable journal. So we want to think about it today because we want to think about how we can guide the research. An important related example is number three. There's certain research that's important but unpopular. So I gave you that whole scenario about Michael Jackson and his father. And part of the point about that is that Not a lot of people are going to spend money on research that might be used to demonstrate that accused abusers are in fact innocent. It's just not the sort of thing that necessarily has such a pretty face that clearly attracts a lot of money. It's still important. We're talking about people who are genuinely innocent. We don't want those people to be imprisoned. But again, without proper funding, it's less clear that that sort of research will be funded, as opposed to the other sorts of research that's trying to demonstrate that an accused abuser is actually guilty. So we want to think about it to guide it for those purposes. And finally, I've mentioned to you certain kinds of proxies that we use in the law. Restrictions on various claims about emotional distress. I've talked about how statutes are often not looking at experiences in a very refined way. Well, part of the reason for this is that it's just been extraordinarily difficult to do that. And so when we imagine a future with better technologies, we might want to think about whether some of these bits of law that have grown in place for, in some cases, hundreds of years are really still appropriate in this future. Let me end with an apocryphal story about Bertrand Russell. Bertrand Russell goes to the dentist, complains of a toothache, and the dentist asks him, "Where does it hurt?" And Russell gives him a kind of puzzled look, and he says, "Why, in my brain, of course." So the message I want to give away here is that, indeed, we can look to the brain to try to figure out more about what people are experiencing, and that we should do that as we approach the experiential future. Thank you.
All right, so as before, I'd like to invite the well-behaved audience members to the center aisle to ask their questions. We'll have about 20 minutes for this.
Transient, it's changing all the time. And I find this to be a really interesting dilemma for clients of mine that might come to see me who are involved in a court case, and they have to demonstrate the level of pain that they're experiencing. But if they come to see me, what I do is I help them to change their experience of their pain, their relationship with their pain, and so it becomes a dilemma for them of how they're working.
Great, could people hear the question? So the nature of the question is that the questioner says that she's a therapist and that she has people who come in who, and she's noticed that the amounts of pain that they experience varies over time. It could be adjusted in various ways. And sometimes there's a kind of conflict because the person may have litigation that's going on, and at the same time, as a therapist, you seek to ease their pain. Did I do justice to your question?
Yes. The experience of their pain can change on a moment-to-moment basis. In a matter of 5 minutes, through a process, somebody can change their entire relationship to their pain. Something that was debilitating and painful for them 45 minutes ago, through a process of trauma work or something like that, they can have a very different experience of their pain at that moment, which can be lasting over time.
Okay, great. So a couple of points. And the first is sort of an aside, but there are studies that look at the ways that people respond to pain if they have ongoing litigation versus similar people and how they respond if they're not involved in ongoing litigation. And it seems to suggest that when you're engaged in ongoing litigation, you have worse recovery from various kinds of pain. That's really interesting for lawyers and law professors to think about and to think about the significance of what that means. And it is also important in thinking about whether or not you want to bring suit under various kinds of conditions. Second point is that, and I could have made this clearer too, is we want to keep in mind differences between acute pain and chronic pain, which I talked about a little bit. Certainly things like acute pain are going to change very rapidly, and we want to think about whether the technology is looking at one of those or the other, and both can be relevant in the law. So one claim could be about the chronic pain in one's back that they're constantly experiencing, or another claim could be every time I flex my knee, I experience acute pain. So they both could be important in various ways. And then to address the question most directly, the claim was that I took the claim to be that people can be healed in some cases, in which case their pain will change. And so partly what we just want to think about is, in the legal system, when are we querying people's pain levels? There are pains that people experienced in the past, and if those have changed, it's hard to imagine the technology that's going to give us a very good sense of what people were experiencing in the past. Maybe some kind of lie detection tool could tell us something about that. But yeah, absolutely. So how do we predict people's future pain? Because that's also part of damage cases. What are they going to experience in the future? Juries and courts will do their best to estimate what they think is going to happen, but it's quite possible that a person can win a very large recovery with the jury assuming a certain level of pain, but then they find a wonderful therapist, perhaps like yourself, and who helps them with the pain, and ordinarily they still get to keep the recovery.
Well, thank you very much for a very engaging lecture. As an ethicist, I'm a bit concerned about the difference between objective harm to someone's well-being and more of the subjective harm. And I'm wondering, when you do an MRI on someone who's a hypochondriac, for example, who genuinely believes that they are experiencing pain, but in reality it's very much psychosomatic, does it show up on the MRI, and what kind of legal implications does that have?
Yes, great question, and one that if I had more time, I definitely should have addressed. I don't think we know well enough to know how a hypochondriac is going to look as opposed to other people. But absolutely, we would expect that it's going to look different from someone else whose cause of pain is quite different in nature. And it's exactly the sort of thing that we want neuroscientists to be testing, right, to try to figure out what the nature of pain is, because pain is multifaceted, right? There are sensory components to it, there are affective components to it, there are cognitive components to it. The way that your ankle feels if you injured it by rescuing a child from a burning building might be very different than someone who has the same exact tissue damage but injured it in failing to rescue that child, right? The pain might feel very different. So I think it's a great point that pain is a difficult thing to measure, even if it's easier than something like deception, but that we're going to want to try to figure out what's the nature of it and what's the cause of it, to the extent that it matters to the law. And surprisingly, the law doesn't do a good job of distinguishing amounts of compensation associated with different levels of pain. So you might wonder, what about a person who has a certain level of pain, but maybe a different pain tolerance? What do we do about that? And I think as a scientist, a scientist might be able to try to distinguish those concepts, but it's not clear how the law would respond to it, because we've never really had to face that kind of question.
Thank you.
Thanks for your talk. And you might have glanced off this in the first question a little bit, and excuse my ignorance of tort law, but early in your talk, you talked about kind of compensation for physical pain. And I'm just thinking, say, you know, if there was a bar fight or something, and one guy's on a rampage and punches three people in the same way, one of them could develop chronic pain, you know, in their face that lasts a lifetime, long after any seeming cause of the pain is gone. Another could be congenitally insensitive to pain and feel nothing whatsoever. Another could be congenitally indifferent to pain and feel the pain but have no emotional reaction to it. And these people could all end up in the same courtroom, and I'm wondering if tort law is equipped to deal with that, or if that's a discussion that some people don't feel pain whatsoever, and other people have, you know, very good coping mechanisms, like maybe a meditation master who got punched would, to their credit, engage a coping mechanism by which they'd experience very little pain. I'm just curious how the law handles that spectrum.
Yeah, great question. And there are these rare people that in some cases congenitally can't feel pain. There's never been a tort case that I know of that's ever tested what do we do when it comes to compensating a person like that. We have to start with the kind of fundamental ethical and legal question about what the tort system is supposed to do. The typical or most common answer is that the tort system is about corrective justice. It's about taking a person who is in one condition, is then injured due to somebody else's negligence, and what do we have to do by way of, say, compensation to bring them back to the status quo, to bring them back to the status quo beforehand. And so that would suggest that if we compare the person who's punched and severely injured to the person who's punched but feels nothing, I believe the tort system, according to the traditional theory, would say that the person who doesn't feel pain gets no compensation for the pain. If there was some other reason they needed medical care or had to go to a doctor, they might get compensated for that. That's the traditional way that it's looked at, and so that's what would follow from the experiential future. But we're always invited to rethink that, to rethink whether that's the appropriate thing to do. If you think that it's about deterring people from punching people, you might say, if you don't know that they're not going to feel the pain, we want to deter you the same amount. So there's a deep underlying theoretical question there.
Thanks very much. I guess the one other thing to mention is some people develop chronic pain from seemingly very trivial physical insults, and I guess maybe that would be the area where it would get a little more difficult to parse.
Yes, and this is an area that the law has done some work on. The general view would be that you take the plaintiff, you take the plaintiff as you found them. So normally you're going to have to pay more when you have a person who's very sensitive to pain or very easily injured, but there are some nuances to that. And of course, again, that's always something that could be reconsidered.
Hi, so I have a question about, you've alluded to privacy concerns, and I assume if we expand this to criminal investigation, also sort of Fifth Amendment concerns about this kind of technology. So if we imagine in our, you know, in our brave new world future where we have some sort of brain scan where we can ask, you know, did you murder Smith? And we can get an answer with sort of, with comparable accuracy to DNA scans today. It seems like there's not any privacy concerns about DNA technology. There's certainly no, I have no like right against self-incrimination for DNA scans. A judge can, you know, order DNA testing or something like that. And it seems like if we were to hook me up to some sort of electrode or brain scan or something like that, the evidence is at least on the surface, it seems to be the same type of evidence. So why should we suppose that there are no privacy concerns or concerns about self-incrimination with DNA, but there might be with a suitably advanced brain scan?
Okay, super. Yeah, I mean, there are certain issues when it comes to genes and things like, you know, what about someone shed DNA, and then can you go to the hairdresser and take it up off the floor? But the issue about the Fifth Amendment and self-incrimination is an interesting one. The provision is usually thought to protect testimonial sorts of statements. So if you say, I'm guilty, that might be something testimonial. It has a certain kind of content to it. By contrast, we might give someone a voice test. We want to know whether the person recognizes the sound of someone's voice, and so then you can make the criminal defendant say things like, you know, a man, a plan, a canal, Panama, because we just want to hear their voice. It's, even though they're speaking, it's not considered testimonial, and typically something like, genes, looking at shed DNA, might not be considered testimonial because it doesn't have that component of an assertion being made by a defendant. Now, what about if you put the person in the scanner and you say to them, did you commit the crime? To the extent that we're looking for a response, that sounds testimonial. That sounds just like cross-examining a witness. But you can imagine the technology where it doesn't require a verbal sort of response. Perhaps you're looking at the scanner and all you have to do is ask the question and see how their brain responds. So you say, do you recognize the picture of this terrorist? And rather than relying on their answer, which certainly could be a lie, we're going to look at their brains and look at what memory processes they engage in and try to determine if it represents someone who's, say, accessing a genuine memory or not. And that's going to be a difficult question about how we might treat that from a Fifth Amendment perspective. And same thing with technologies that are looking at experiences, because the lie detection stuff isn't necessarily looking at an experience, but you can imagine that a person says that it could bear on a criminal case whether a person injured their back in some respect, and you can imagine putting them in a scanner to look at whether or not they're experiencing pain without asking them a question, and that would be a tough case that we haven't yet confronted.
Hi, really just two questions. The first one, to the extent that we can actually begin to demonstrate emotional damages with, say, fMRIs, are we going to collapse in the legal system the difference between a physical harm and an emotional harm? Second question, if it's good for the defendants, what about the judge? What about the jurors? Your Honor, can you be impartial? Juror number 10, can you be impartial in this case? You see that as being actually inhibitory for the legal system to start introducing this technology, because judges are probably going to see down the road, that may be applied to me.
Okay, super. So the first part of the question was about physical harms versus, say, emotional harms. And I think that's an area where a lot of us think that that's not a super important difference. In other words, they're both various kinds of distressing things, and that unlike certain kinds of distinctions between, say, what's psychological and neurological, it's all going to be neurological at some level. And this is already an area where, in some courts, the distinction between what's a physical harm and what's a kind of psychiatric or emotional harm is already starting to disappear. So there are some cases that are looking at PTSD. So someone's in a car accident and they develop PTSD, and the question is whether this was a physical injury or not. And this is an area where perhaps courts wouldn't have considered it physical in the past. They would have thought of it as psychological or mental. Some courts are now starting to think of that as a physical injury, and sometimes it makes a difference for recovery under various kinds of statutes. And it makes sense to me that it's not a clear distinction between what's a physical kind of injury in the sense, because courts think, oh, if you can show us some evidence in the brain, now it becomes a physical injury, that's not a ethically meaningful difference between what's a physical injury and what's an emotional injury. So it's not clear why you want to make your statutes refer to compensation in one case as opposed to the other. The second part of the question was about biases, and I think you meant something like, might we use brain imaging to tell us something about whether a juror will be, say, racially biased or gender biased? Yeah, and whether or not that's experiential is interesting. It might depend on how you run the test. I don't know that there's any basis for conducting a kind of invasive examination on a juror, but certainly we already query jurors in various ways when we decide that it's appropriate for them to serve on the jury. Are you willing to favor the death penalty in a case that meets the proper circumstances? We do ask jurors questions like that. I don't see quite how we get to the more physical kind of invasion, but it would be an interesting question in the future.